the CMU podcast, in association with 7 Digital.
This week, Blurred Lines, BBC iPlayer Radio, The Mike Coalition and The Foo Fighters. I'm Andy Maltz, I am the editor of CMU. Chris Cook, who is the business editor of CMU, is here too, because that's how this podcast works.
We both sit in a room and we talk.
Yes.
It's a winning concept.
How have you been, Chris?
I have been very busy.
Because I know sometimes we feign the fact that we haven't seen each other all week, but I actually haven't seen you this week.
It is true. We've immed quite a lot, but we've not been in the same room as each other very much. And I know it's July, and July is when most people sort of go on holiday, and they all take it easy. And in the music industry, you start getting more and more out of offices because basically there's a whole chunk of the music industry who just, you know, once Glastonbury's happened, it's just like, well, we'll just go to festival after festival after festival and not really do any work. And although we've had Apple Music and we had the global release day, so we've had some big developments, but nobody releases music in August, do they? Years and years have got their album out now. That's really it.
That's done.
There'll be lots of indie labels listening saying, what do you mean we carry on? But in terms of the big...
Shut up, indie labels.
In terms of the big releases, that's it till September. Everyone's taking it, everyone's chilling. But we have another publication in addition to CMU called 3 Weeks Edinburgh. It's a sister publication to This Week London. So actually that's two more sister publications. The point is...
It's a big family.
...that we have a magazine that covers the Edinburgh Festival, the world's biggest cultural event that takes place in Edinburgh. That's why it's called the Edinburgh Festival. The yep. clue is in the name. For the duration of August, and it's theatre and it's comedy. There's actually a really big music programme. It's just that that's a secret and no one talks about it. And there's spoken word and there's dance and blah, blah, blah. And it's a really exciting place to be. And we are, you know, one of the main media that covers that festival, which makes August incredibly busy. And it also makes July incredibly busy because there's lots of work to be done. And also all the things I would be doing normally, I can't do it in August, I'm too busy. So I have to do double in July. So basically, I'm having a really busy time.
Whereas I just work on CMU, so there's just nothing to be done. I've been lying around in the sunshine eating ice cream.
Why are we talking about the...
That is not true. I've been working very hard.
You've been eating something else other than ice cream.
I have eaten ice cream.
While I'm talking about the Edinburgh Festival, I should mention that this year I've been covering the Edinburgh Festival for 20 years. Okay, so 3 weeks Edinburgh.
Who would have thought you were old enough?
Exactly. 3 weeks Edinburgh. Someone actually said that to me the other day.
Really?
I was explaining to them the story of
sorry, I didn't mean to say really so incredulously.
of my company and 3 weeks and CMU and blah, blah, blah. And I said, well, I set it all up when I was a student in Edinburgh in the 90s. And they're like, oh, you're obviously older than you look. So there you go. I'm glad to have got that down on record. I'm not making that up. That
right.
is true.
Well, in order for me not to have to respond to that, should we move on to the first story?
Well, I had a link.
Oh, did you?
You're ruining
oh,
my
I'm
link
sorry.
Here.
Well, that's sort of the theme, isn't it? That's what we do.
20 years I've been covering the oh, right, festival, yeah. and this year, for the first time, I'm doing a show.
Oh, yeah.
So on top of everything else, I've got to write a bloody show, and some people have already booked in, so I am going to have to write this show. And I'm not quite
Don't
sure...
let them know you haven't written it.
I'm not quite sure why I'm admitting that I haven't really written it yet. I know what I'm doing. It's sort of in my head. I've just got to write it down and get it finalised. It's called Chris Cook's Free Speech. It's a free speech about free speech. You will see why this is not just a blatant plug. It's a very clever link.
I can see what's coming.
The very clever link is coming. And it's all about free speech, and it's based around the concept that not this year, but the year before, the CMU strands at the Great Escape in 2014, we had a strand called Blurred Lines, Does Pop Have a Misogyny Problem? Looking at sort of sexism in the music industry and in pop music. And as part of that, we had a debate, an old school debate. This house believes that British radio should have banned Blurred Lines. That, you know, monstrosity of a hit that was big news in whichever year, 2013, I assume, yep. it came out, if we were talking about it in 2014. And so should radio have been playing Blurred Lines? Because of not obviously, you know, a lot of people talk about the video of Blurred Lines. We weren't talking about the video. We were talking about the lyrical content and all the various things that people have said about it. And so we had a debate. Should we ban Blurred Lines? And we had some radio people saying, no, we don't like the lyrics of this song, but you should never ban music. And then we had Sussex University, who had banned Blurred Lines, saying this is why we banned it and radio should have banned it too. But I couldn't find anybody in the music industry or the media who would go on stage at the Great Escape and say, yeah, Radio 1 should have banned Blurred Lines. So I did it, because I'd already sent my programme to press, which had the debate in it, so I couldn't cancel the event. So I did it, and in doing so, in writing my little speech, I convinced myself that actually British radio should have banned Blurred Lines.
Because you wouldn't have said that previously.
Well, that my had... Edinburgh University was the first university to ban it on campus. You remember quite a few universities in Edinburgh banned it from student radio and from student club nights. And if that had happened when I was a student in Edinburgh in the 90s, I would have been so against that. And I would have led a campaign. Censorship is wrong. Free speech, you know, should rule. And yet 20 years on, I've sort of changed my mind. So that is what I'm exploring in the show, chriscooksfreespeech.com. If you're in Edinburgh, come and see it. I'm only doing 5 performances. I will write it, so do come. This is a very long link, because we're talking about blurred lines.
Yes.
But not the lyrical content. We're not here to dismiss the misogyny and the rape apology that exists in the lyrics of this song. This is all about copyright.
Yes, this is about the musical content and that was created for it. I mean, I'm sure people noticed and remember there was a trial around this. Marvin Gaye's family sued Pharrell Williams and Robin Thicke, accusing them of copyright infringement, of ripping off Marvin Gaye's Got to Give It Up for Blurred Lines. Now, obviously, Robin Thicke and Pharrell Williams said, no, we didn't. But there were some interesting things that came out of the trial. Have a quick recap of them. So what was Robin Thicke's defence?
Yes, the amusing testimonies. Actually, I don't think this wasn't during the trial. This was a deposition
before
the trial.
This is a deposition before, yeah.
And he basically said, when you say that they sued Robin Thicke and Pharrell Williams, and that is correct, then both their names were on the legal papers. They both had to give depositions. They both had to turn up in court. But it transpired from the case, really, they were suing Pharrell Williams. Because Robin Thicke, who back in interviews, when the record came out, said, oh, yeah, we went in the studio and we jammed. What he actually said was, I said to Pharrell Williams, I really like this Marvin Gaye track, to do something like that, which is where this entire case came from.
Yep.
But he was sort of saying how they collaborated and blah, blah, blah. And when it came to actually sitting down on oath, he sort of said, I was spaced out of my head. I was, you know, I had a prescription drug problem. I had no idea what was going on. And basically, I missed the studio time and I rocked up in the evening. Pharrell had already done all of the work. I just sang some vocals and I didn't really know what happened. So it was sort of, A, it was amusing. I don't know why it was amusing that Robin Thicke was having such a hard time. But I should retract that statement. But then again, it is Robin Thicke.
Well, we could move on to Pharrell Williams. Pharrell wasn't having a problem at all. But his deposition, he basically said, no, of course I didn't rip off Marvin Gaye. I mean, I respect Marvin Gaye because... What was he? He said, oh, he's an Aquarius, so I respect him. Something like that. Like, it was really kind of throwaway.
It seemed to be that whenever Pharrell spoke, it was like, are these words in a sentence? or are you just randomly picking out words? So both the testimonies were quite amusing. And it has to be said, I didn't think that the Gaye family had that great a case. Because if you listen to the two tracks, you can tell, yes, there is a similarity. But it's almost one of those things that I'm not sure if someone hadn't pointed it out to me, I'm not sure I would immediately, had I gone back to that Marvin Gaye track just, you know, randomly, I don't think I would have immediately said, oh my God, this is Blurred Lines.
No, and I suppose the defence was, yeah, they sound kind of similar, but they sound, not because one person ripped off another, but because... One is a 70s funk track and one is sort of trying to write something that sounds like a 70s funk track. So there's just kind of thematic similarities that are, you know, specific to that genre. And, yeah.
It's not a straight rip.
And that seemed like a fair defence, but the jury did not agree.
No, it's an interesting thing. I mean, a trial like this in the UK would not go in front of a jury, but they do in America. And whenever you have a jury trial, I mean, we all think, oh, trial by jury, that's always the better route. If you can go before a jury, that's what we should do. It shouldn't just be old, you know, crusty old judges making these decisions. The problem with juries is it does then sort of become theatre. It's which you know, lawyer on the day in court convinces the jury, plays to the jury, and the Gaye family had a really good... I mean, actually, Thicke and Pharrell had a very esteemed lawyer, but the guy representing the Gaye family managed to talk them round. And there was the whole copyright technicality issue, that this was about the song, not the recording, OK? So it was the copyright in the song, and then... The lawyers for Pharrell and for Robin Thicke said, but actually, for various complicated reasons we won't go into, only the core of the song is protected by copyright, i.e. the sheet music. And quite a lot of what you could argue Pharrell had nicked from the Marvin Gaye song wasn't actually core sheet music. It was some of the other bits and pieces that were added in when the recording was made. And interestingly, you know, the lawyers for Pharrell and for Thicke said, so, but those bits aren't even protected by copyright. Very early on in the trial, the judge seemed to say, as far as I could see, yeah, you're right. Because then there was the debate that meant they couldn't actually play the record Blurred Lines in Court. No,
Robin Thicke did a turn on the piano. He had to play talk about it being theatre.
He had to play it on the piano so that it was just the core composition. And yet, when it came to the ruling, that whole thing seemed to go out of the window, which was one of the reasons why lawyers for Farrell and Thicke didn't just appeal, they asked for a retrial. They said that they thought there were some fundamental problems with the case and they wanted to basically scrap that and start again. And so that was one of various things that the judge was ruling on this week. That wasn't the only post-trial application or request that was made that the judge was ruling on this week. What else was he giving his opinion on?
Well, I think there were four specific things. We should say that the Gay family didn't just win. They won fairly spectacularly and were awarded $7.3 million in damages at the original trial. And so, yes, Thicke and Williams' lawyer were calling for a retrial, saying that this was all ridiculous. So that was one of the things this
week. And also they questioned even if we don't go to retrial, that's... And in copyright cases in America, juries always reward ridiculous damages.
Yeah.
And we've seen it in the piracy cases too. And so they were saying, A, we want a retrial, and B, even before we get to that, that's a ridiculous sum of money.
Yes. So, but this week, the request for a retrial was refused. The judge said they hadn't actually provided any evidence that there should be a retrial. So that was thrown out. But there was a slight win. The Gay family had requested that there be an injunction placed on distribution of the track. So it would have to be taken off sale completely while they worked out how much future royalties they should receive, which would basically mean like not just taking CDs out of the shops, but actually like pulling it off iTunes, Spotify, everything, until they'd had an accountant look through the accounts. And that was refused because it was quite daft. However, they will get 50% of all future publishing royalties from the track, so that's one win back to them. I think that's now 2-1. Bringing it equal again, the money that Pharrell Williams was ordered to pay was cut to $5.3 million, as the bulk of it was placed on him.
So although the judge was mainly there, sort of, I think, ruling in favour of the Gay family in sort of saying, OK, we won't allow the retrial and we will just decide you're getting 50% of the money, although there was a little bit of, you know, a handful of wins for the other side in terms of reducing the damages, not banning the distribution of the track in the short term. And then the other element that was being reviewed this week was that the Gay family, in addition to wanting more from Pharrell and Robin Thicke, they also wanted Universal Music, which released the track, and they wanted Ty, and to be fair to Ty...
Oh, he just turned up and did a bit of a rap on it.
and right at the last minute. He wasn't there in the early stages when the track was being made. But they wanted both Universal and Ty, because both of those people obviously have benefited from the... So they say they've benefited from the copyright infringement, so they should be held liable too. And so that was another thing that the Gay family were asking for. And Universal Music submitted some papers a few weeks ago saying that would be a breach of the Seventh Amendment. The Seventh Amendment is the right to a trial by jury in America. And they would say, what they were saying was, well, this issue came up during the trial. And the jury specifically said, no, we don't think that Universal and Ty should be held liable for this. So if you, the judge, now go back on that, well, basically, you're dismissing the jury and that is against the Seventh Amendment. But the judge wasn't impressed by that. Because he did say Universal and Ty should be held jointly liable. I don't quite know what that means in practical terms, whether it means now the Gay family could go after both of those for some money in addition to the whatever. I mean, even though it's been cut, it's still a lot of money that they're getting off Pharrell. It's over $5
million. Yeah.
Whether they could now go after Universal, who obviously have deeper pockets than everyone else, to get some more money, or they could get some of the recording money, I don't know. But Universal and Ty... didn't manage to wash their hands of this whole thing.
So I think that puts this stage at 3-2 to the Gay family. However,
it's not all over yet.
Not unsurprisingly, after that ruling yesterday, Thicke and Williams lawyer Howard King said that they would be appealing the whole trial. However, having failed to get a retrial, they're going to go down the appeal route.
And he is still insisting that his clients were innocent, they are not liable for copyright infringement, and went through all the things you were saying, which is it was just a style of music, it was a genre. No one songwriter can claim to own a style or a genre, and we're confident this will come up in the appeal. Whereas the legal rep for the Gay family, although it was a bit of a mixed bag judgment, you know, as we say, some one way, some the other, I think it was more... a victory for the gay family.
Well, they still stand to get a lot of money.
And so he welcomed the ruling. He said, I'm going to look into this reducing of the damages. But basically, after the trial where the jury sided for the gay family, Pharrell and Robin Thicke and their people went on this massive PR campaign. Actually, I think he went on quite a PR campaign as well, if I remember, but went on this massive PR campaign. And there was a lot of comment articles, wasn't there, about, yeah, you know, what precedent does this set? Is this dangerous for the art of songwriting? Actually, I don't think that really was a result of a PR campaign on the part of Pharrell and Robin Thicke. That was just that's the obvious thing that every journalist in the world is, yeah, going to write an article about when something like this happens. And, I mean, there is the element of, you know, does it set a dangerous precedent? I mean, you were wondering, what was the story this week? Where
I was going to say that was as an interesting aside. Now, whether or not there's any link between these two things or not, who knows? But it came out, actually, this is something Miguel said in an interview with an Australian website a couple of weeks ago, but it's sort of...
Everyone's talking about it this week.
But Miguel, one of the tracks on his CMU-approved new album, Wild Heart, he's given a credit to Billy Corgan from the Smashing Pumpkins. And he's given that specifically because he said in this interview, he kind of, after he'd recorded the track, he wrote the track really quickly, similar to Blurred Lines, you know, and at the end of it, he was like, oh, I really like that, it's really good. Does sound a little bit like 1979 by the Smashing Pumpkins. So he sent the track to Billy Corgan and said, are you all right with this? And has ended up giving Billy Corgan a writing credit on it.
And possibly some money. Now, normally, with a credit comes a cut.
Quite probably some money. Now, I think that album was finished quite some time ago. So I'm not saying that that's the result of this ruling, but it is interesting that it's come out and this is happening because there's other things... I mean, other things like this, Sam Smith's Stay With Me, Tom Petty obviously went to him and said, this sounds
very like
Won't Back Down.
Yeah.
And Sam Smith and his publishers said, well, it's not, but all right, have a writing credit.
And presumably some money.
But
what was interesting about the Miguel story was that wasn't that the record had gone out and then either the other songwriter or a publisher for that songwriter.
No, Miguel
said,
went to
exactly,
Billy Corgan.
Which makes you think, is it now that songwriters are being a little bit more nervous about that sort of thing?
Yeah.
That said, in terms of, you know, does this set a wide-ranging precedent? I mean, there is always the issue that pursuing a case like the Blurred Lines case, like the gay family have done, is an incredibly big task. It's a very expensive thing to do. It will last for months, probably years.
And you're not always going to get $7.3 million out of it at the end.
And also, I mean, even if this sort of sets a precedent so that, you know, there is a case, it's still very, you know, you would never go, particularly with a jury trial, you would never go into the court knowing what the outcome was going to be. It's always a risk. It's a lot of money to spend, yeah, with a lot of risk. You're only going to do that if there's a lot of money on the table potentially at the end of it. And most single tracks don't make that much money. You know, Blurred Lines was the biggest track of its year and actually one of the biggest tracks of the last 5 years. There are very few tracks where having 50% of it is as valuable as having 50% of Blurred Lines.
Yeah.
So I think in the main, you're not going to see lots and lots of cases like this. But it is interesting, is it making songwriters, as you say, we don't know about Miguel, it may be that actually all of this predates the trial.
I mean, his comment was like, oh, you know, this is about respecting other artists and realising that things can seep in subconsciously without you realising, and, you know, he just wants to make it right. It might be that he's just a nice guy. But equally, it might be that, yeah, like you say, there might be a little bit more fear around just sort of putting stuff out and hoping people won't notice. Because in fairness, it's a similar thing. There's a similarity between 1979 and Leaves, which is the Miguel track, but only in the guitar playing slightly similar. I mean, it sounds like a lot of songs because, you know, a lot of songs sound the same.
Well, for that, obviously, when the jury reached its decision earlier in the year on this case, there was at least one article I read, and I think there was two or three of these articles, looking at Marvin Gaye's music and tracking that back and saying, well, clearly this Marvin Gaye track was influenced by this track from 20 years earlier.
Well, you can go back and find quotes from Marvin Gaye and his songwriter saying, oh, we were going for sort of the feel of this song from, you know, 5-10 years ago when we wrote this. So it's like Marvin Gaye was doing the same thing.
But
anyway, let's not get into that whole debate again.
Even though I wasn't convinced by the case of the gay family, I still find it highly amusing that Robin Thicke and Pharrell had to give up all of that money. And the one thing we definitely know is this case is not going away just yet. There is an appeal coming. Who knows when that will happen? I suspect they will keep appealing until they've run out of all routes of appeal. So there's plenty more time for us to be able to have a sort of laugh at Robin Thicke's embarrassing admissions and Pharrell's utter nonsense whenever he opens his mouth.
Yes, probably not the last time you've heard this story on the CMU podcast.
So, something to look forward to.
So last week there was an interesting develop in the world of radio when the BBC announced that it was banning songs by Neil Young, Bonnie Raitt, The Doors and Journey from all of its radio stations, and not just their recordings, but any covers or even songs that sample their songs.
You say announced, they issued a memo internally.
Yeah, well they announced it internally and someone leaked it, that's how announcements
work. And then the memo was emailed to lots of people like us. Yes, so if you're a fan of Neil Young or Bonnie Raitt or The Doors or Journey, do not expect to be hearing their songs on BBC Radio.
Now,
but this
usually,
is not a, this is not a Frankie Goes to Hollywood type thing. It's not Blurred Lines being banned like I think they should have done.
And it's not the normal normally in a situation like this. Well, I suppose this is all BBC Radio stations. But normally, if when Radio 1 don't playlist a Madonna track, then the Daily Mail and the Sun and everyone who hates the BBC writes 1,000 articles saying this is ageism at the BBC and it's awful. But the BBC had fairly specific reasons for this. It's because those specific artists are not members of the MCPS. And there is a new BBC iPlayer radio app coming out, which will allow you to cache radio shows offline for listening when you're on the tube or whatever, or you know, otherwise out of Wi-Fi contact.
Which I must admit, I always assumed it did anyway.
No, it didn't.
Well, no, it didn't. I know it didn't now, but I because obviously...
I always found that very annoying, because there was always stuff I wanted to cache for offline listening.
Because obviously, you know, services like Spotify, that's part of their mobile app, so you can have your playlist playing when you're not in mobile reception. And the iPlayer TV app has offered downloads before.
Yes.
So it's just specifically the radio player app has not offered that, but by the time you hear this, it should be, because the aim was to have it live by the time the proms started, because apparently lots of people will want to have the proms cached on their phones. So the proms are starting tonight, if you're listening to this on Friday, and so we were told by the BBC that the all-new iPlayer radio app should be live by Friday. And it will have the caching, but no Neil Young.
Yes, because there's a blanket license that the BBC has with the MCPS that would allow for caching songs offline. That's fine. Except, as I said, these four artists not registered with the MCPS, which causes problems because it means they have to do direct deals with those artists and their publishers. And it just seems like they can't be asked.
Now, the interesting thing, of course, is that there are different kinds of licences for radios. This is all to do with the songs. This is nothing to do with recordings. Yeah. We're talking about song copyright.
Which is why covers and sampled
are also included.
Are,
exactly. And when you broadcast music out on radio, if it's AM or FM on a standard radio station, you don't need a mechanical rights licence, because the argument is that there are different elements to the copyright. We've talked about this before, I'm sure, on the podcast. So there's the performing rights bit, there's the mechanical right bit. There's some other bits too, but we don't need to talk about that. And when you broadcast, it's what in copyright terms is called communicating to the public. Okay, so as far as copyright law is concerned, when you have an AM/FM broadcast, that's what's happening. And that comes under the performing rights. And the performing rights are administered by the Performing Rights Society, or PRS. So providing you have a PRS licence, you can use any of the songs which are affiliated to PRS, including Neil Young, he's a member of PRS, Bonnie Raitt, member of PRS. So you can play all of those on AM/FM radio, that's fine. The minute you start doing things digitally, when you start streaming content rather than pumping it out through AM and FM, there's still a communication to the public, but there's also some copying going on, because that's how streaming works. And so you reach a point where actually your PRS license is no longer enough. Now you need this MCPS license, the Mechanical Copyright Protection Society. You could say that the minute you start webcasting, you should need the MCPS license. But basically, the music industry allows you to just have it as a communication to the public until a certain sort of random point.
It's complicated enough already. But yeah, there is a certain point at which they go, right, now you're definitely making a mechanical copy.
Even though clearly all of those streams you've been doing all these years technically were a mechanical copy, but we're going to draw the line. And the minute you start caching, that's where the line is drawn. And now we're going to say, OK, now there's a definitely mechanical copy, and therefore you need this separate license. And so that's why this has happened now. This is why this upgrade of the iPlayer radio app has this impact, because although the BBC can get a joint licence, so although we have the performing rights, the mechanical rights, PRS, MCPS, it's all actually joined up as a licensee. You go to PRS for music, which represents both PRS rights and MCPS rights, and you get the joint licence. It's all fine. You fill out some paperwork, blah, blah, blah. But the societies can only give you the repertoire that they have the rights to. And as you say, these four songwriters are not in MCPS, although they are in PRS. Why are they not in MCPS, Andy Malt?
They're not in MCPS because they didn't want to be part of the blanket licence for TV sync.
Yes. So they have nothing about the mechanical side of radio. They don't really have any... As far as we're aware, they don't have any
opinions.
They're
not fussed about radio. They just don't. They don't want to become, I don't know, the XX and have their music on TV constantly.
So with sync...
It's not often you hear someone say that Neil Young doesn't want to become the XX.
Well, who knows? It could be a regular feature
maybe,
on the podcast.
You know, he's still making music, so maybe his next album.
When you synchronise music to video, there is, again, there's often a mechanical copy and a performing right. It's like radio. The mechanical copy happens when you actually do the synchronisation and you copy the music onto your video. And then every time you sort of distribute the video, it's either a communication to the public or a public performance, depending how you do it. So with sync, you need both bits, a PRS bit and an MCPS bit. And in the UK, both societies for TV sync offer a blanket licence, not for film. Can't have it for film. You can't do the mechanical bit through MCPS for film. You can't for advertising. You can't for video games. They do. I think they do have a license, but the vast majority of publishers and songwriters are not part of it. But with TV, it's done through a blanket license. And if you join MCPS, it's compulsory. Once you're in, you have to be part of the TV sync deal. You can't join MCPS for all the other stuff they do, but say, oh, I'm not doing the TV sync. It's one of the rules of membership. And that's what Neil Young et al. Don't like. In America, the mechanical bit of sync is never done through a blanket license. Every deal has to be done directly, and they like that. I suspect that what's happened here, because this isn't, it's not that they've suddenly withdrawn from MCPS. They've not been members of MCPS.
Oh, yeah, this isn't, that bit of it is not a new development.
Yeah, they've not been members of MCPS for years. And I suspect what's happened is that Neil Young's been over in the UK, in his hotel room, he's got the TV on, and I don't know, the One show's come on. And then suddenly one of his songs is soundtracking some really terrible feature on the One show. And he's like, who allowed this to happen? And then his publishers said, oh, there's nothing we can do about that. It's under the blanket license. And he's like, right, I'm going to withdraw. And what that means is if you release a Neil Young CD, you can't license the song bit through MCPS. You have to go and do a direct deal. But then not that many people are releasing CDs of Neil Young songs. So that's not necessarily an issue. But it's interesting that because of the whims of this iPlayer Radio app and the fact that you say, well, at this point, digital distribution becomes mechanical copies, that's now an issue. So who knows? I mean, will it force Neil Young et al. To have a rethink now that basically they're off all BBC Radio?
Because presumably, I mean, it's not that they've been banned from all BBC Radio on the off chance that someone caches one of the shows onto their phone. So actually, for something that's probably not going to happen that often, they're not getting played at all anywhere.
Yes, and you know they could still have it on AM and FM, but they'd then have to stop it going into the app. And with radio, it's all automated at the BBC. You know, a minute the show goes out on air, the computer grabs it off the system, pumps it through to the iPlayer, and they don't want to have a system where they're sort of ticking a box and say, oh, no, we can't have this. You know, we have to edit these 10 minutes out because there's a song here we're not covered. Now, I suspect, actually, even if that happened, I can't see these guys would be suing the BBC for the 22 people that cashed. I mean, it's not like these guys' music is being played all that much on BBC Radio.
Well, Journey, I don't know you say it, but Journey's off of the back of Glee, and
that's
Journey
true.
Were in the charts again a couple of years
it
ago.
It is true,
it?
But I think that moment's gone.
Well, I know that moment's gone, but I'm sure they're getting played somewhere.
So, yeah, so it is the BBC being uber cautious, as the BBC are prone to be, and sort of saying, well, we just won't play them. And obviously, if somebody wants to do a six music documentary about Neil Young, then they'd go to his publishers and they'd license it and blah, blah, blah. But the general rule now has been, and then the memo listed every single sort of manifestation of when you might be using these people's music. And basically, the rule was, we're just not going to play their music. So you won't be able to hear Neil Young on the radio. Where else won't you be able to hear Neil Young?
On any streaming service whatsoever at all.
So you sort of think that Neil Young won't be that bothered about the BBC thing, because it seems like he doesn't want people to hear his music unless they have a super hi-fi.
Well, yeah,
and a
I'd
super
imagine.
Hi-fi
I mean,
service.
I mean, well, yeah, he's withdrawn all of his music from streaming services because he doesn't believe the audio quality is good enough on streaming services. Regardless of the fact that some of them, you know, you've got Tidal, which is obviously high definition music.
I assume with that, though, if you're part of Tidal, yes, Tidal and indeed Deezer have the high quality sound element. but they also have a standard sound element. Yes. And you probably can't be in one without the other. So I assume that would be how he would justify that.
But I'm just thinking, if he's offended by streaming music, then, I mean, radio quality isn't that great, so he's probably quite happy to have his music. I think, basically, Neil Young wants you to only listen to his music on his Pono player.
Which is his own high-quality download service, of which Andy is famously a big fan of that service. I mean, some people did call him out on Facebook, and I think in my write-up of him pulling from streaming, I was sort of saying, what about cassettes? I mean, remember the sound quality on a cassette? It wasn't great.
Well, Neil Young, was it last year or the year before, in recent history, recorded a whole album on one of those, I think, like Jack White's sort of, whatever it was, like 1950s recording, like instant vinyl recording booth, where the quality would be awful. And he was quite happy with that.
But on Facebook, some fans were saying, well, hang on a second, what about cassette? What about AM radio? It's not like, you know, everyone has always listened to your music. But he was coming back on that and saying, no, I genuinely believe that streaming is worse.
He said streaming is the worst audio in history.
So there you go.
Which is just not true. Also, like, Neil Young's been playing massive stages for like 50 odd years. I'm sure he can barely hear anything at all anymore.
Well, that may well be the problem.
It sounds awful. It's like, no, you just can't
hear.
That's
your tinnitus kicking in. So no Neil Young on the BBC, no Neil Young on Spotify. Basically, the only people who will be allowed to hear Neil Young songs are either people who buy tickets to his gigs or the 43 people who are downloading to their Pono devices.
Idiots, all of them.
Yes. Now, it seems to me that it's that point in the podcast where we run through the music that Andy has been approving in the CMU Daily this week.
It does seem like that point.
That's how it's feeling. So I think we'll just jump straight in. I'll shout out the names of the artists you've approved. You'll tell us why people should be checking out their music. And we'll start off with what we've decided is called Creon.
No, we haven't.
Have we not?
No, I think we said Curion.
I reckon Creon.
Curion. Curion.
Are you going to insist Curion. That I spell all the artists that you've approved?
Yes.
Q-R-I-O-N. Why did you improve? Why did you approve that?
It was fine as it was. I didn't improve it at all. So Curion is a Japanese producer. She has just pulled together her first EP, which is a kind of a collection of four tracks she's released on SoundCloud over the last year or so. She's released quite a lot of tracks on SoundCloud. She's collaborated with Ryan Hemsworth. She's remixed a lot of people. There are a lot of her tracks around, and these are sort of four of her best, I guess. And she's released a video for a track called Nothing, which is the final track on the EP, which is, I suppose, I mean, there's a lot of variation in her production, and this one's kind of built around a very simple piano loop and then kind of layers other things on top of it. It's quite a simple production, but it's really effective, quite hypnotic. It's just, I don't know, go and check that one out. It's a good track to listen to.
Next. Peluche, who have teamed up with the Speedy Wonderground, or Vunderground, I don't quite know how they say it, Venture.
Yeah.
Explain that and this release.
So Speedy Wonderground is a label. Basically, they release singles and they try to encourage, they do, because that's
insist.
The whole point. They get their artists who they sign to record tracks as quickly as possible, I suppose, to kind of capture the creative energy straight away.
Yeah, so they record on one day, they mix on the second day, and then they send it off to be pressed to vinyl, and at that point it ceases to be Speedy, because it's really hard getting vinyl pressed these days, and it takes about a year. But the actual recording and capturing bit is really fast.
Yes, so there's Peluche, who are a London band. The Speedy Wonderground people saw a gig at the beginning of the week and had the track recorded by the end of the week, I think. It's a track called The Guy with the Gammy Eye. It's a really kind of dreamy... It starts off very sort of floaty and dreamy, and then the whole track kind of kicks in, but it keeps that sort of weird, dreamy feel throughout. It's very kind of... float. I'm not explaining this very well, but listen to it.
It's a lot easier when you're doing the approved verbally, because you can say, it's also, which I don't think would work in writing. So it's good we're doing this on the podcast now. More Japanese music now. Spangle Call Lily Line.
Which is, I mean, don't need to add anything more with a name like that. I think the name says everything that you need to know. It's obvious what that came from, maybe. to someone. They're a band, they've actually formed in 1998. They've been around for quite a long time. They've released about 10 albums, but they have been on hiatus for 5 years. Haven't done anything at all except release a best of, which you would think would be the sign that...
The hiatus was becoming a finale.
That's it. This is the end. But no, they're back. They're playing a gig in Tokyo in October, if you want to go to that. And they're also going to be releasing a new album in the autumn. And they've released the first track off that album, which is called Azure. And it's quite actually it's a bit rougher around the edges, a bit harder than their older material, which is a bit more sort of jangly pop sort of stuff. It's still got quite a, I'm going to keep using the same words over and again. It's like not so much dreamy. It feels like the sort of track that you'd walk around the streets late night listening to on headphones.
It's so it's not another
nighttime
one.
Nighttime feel.
It's not another one that's a bit.
No, not that at all. I mean, maybe a little.
But not
like as much as the last one.
So more. Mint.
Mint. Or mint.
Yeah, it's a Y in it.
She's got an extra Y in there. She's got a new track out called Civil War, which is the third track she's put up on SoundCloud, or at least the third track since she wiped everything and pretended to be brand new, which is what people generally do. That's fine. That's how music marketing works these days. You pretend you're new. Anyway, it's very good. She's a pop artist from Sweden, as they all are, and this track's got quite a creepy pace to it. It's very and then has these layers of percussion and this kind of great vocal over the top. It fits in really well with the other two tracks that she released, which I should mention. One is called Nick Drake, and that says that she doesn't. It repeats over and over again that she doesn't care about the radio. And the one thing I was thinking is like, well, it sounds like it would get on the radio though. And then she's done a cover of Baby One More Time by Britney Spears, which you'd think if I said to you someone had done sort of a smoky acoustic cover of that song, you would think, well, that sounds really, really awful. And that is what I would think. But actually, she pulls it off. It works.
So there you go. Lots of things to be checking out. CompleteMusicUpdate.com/approved. And you can read more and listen to all of those tracks and see whether or not you agree that at least two of them are sort of...
In a good way.
In a good way.
So this week we've got news out of the US that NPR had followed Amazon's lead in pulling out of the Mic Coalition.
We did.
Yes, the MIC Coalition. But what is that, Chris Cook?
The MIC Coalition is a lobbying group that was launched earlier this year. So there's lots of copyright things that are being reviewed in the US. I think we've mentioned on the podcast before, when it comes to copyright law, every country is different, but there's a lot of copyright systems have a lot in common in most countries, certainly across Europe. That's partly because of the European Union. And in many other places around the world, things work quite similar, apart from in the US. And everything's different in the US. And there's various things that are being reviewed at a political level in Washington and by Congress at the moment. The two biggies are that the music publishers want to have the flexibility to pull out of the collective licensing system, out of BMI and ASCAP, so the American equivalents of PRS, when it comes to digital. So they want to be able to license digital services directly, but carry on licensing radio and cafes and live music through the collective licensing system, which is basically what has happened here in Europe. So now over here, if you're a Spotify-type service, when you're licensing the song copyrights, you can license so much through PRS, so through the collecting society, but then you have to go and do a deal with Warner and Universal and Sony and BMG and Cobalt and get some separate licenses in place. There's some complicated mechanical performing rights stuff going on there too, but let's not talk about that. All you need to know is that over here, some digital licensing, particularly with multi-territory services, is now happening direct rather than through the collective licensing system on the publishing side. In the US, they want to do the same. Basically, they think they'll get more money. Sony ATV reckons if we could license Pandora direct rather than through the collective licensing system, we'll get more cash. Because when you license collectively, ultimately, if you can't agree on terms, copyright law says if it's a collective licensing scenario, you can't agree on terms, it has to go to the copyright court and a judge will decide. So that limits how much money you can get out of the system. So if only we can license directly, we'll get more money, says Sony ATV, but they're not allowed to. the courts in America decided you're either in collective licensing or you're not. So you either do everything collectively or you do nothing collectively. And so they want the rules changed so that they can license digital directly, carry on licensing everything else collectively. That involves a review of the consent decrees, which is the stuff that covers collective licensing in the US. So that's one of the big issues. The other one is to do with recording rights, sound recording rights. At the moment in the US, when FM and AM radio plays a sound recording, so a record, it's probably another way of saying that.
I did say that.
Then they have to pay the music publishers some money through the collective licensing system, as it happens, but they don't have to pay the record companies anything. Whereas over here in the UK, when Radio 1 plays a record, it has to pay some money to the publishers through PRS and MCPS now. It has to pay some money to the record companies through PPL, and they both get some cash, and then that gets shared with the songwriters and the artists. Whereas in the US, only the publishers and the songwriters get paid by radio. The record companies and recording artists do not, and that's unusual. US is the exception generally, and so the record industry is trying to get that changed, and it's called the Fair... All the legislation in America have stupid names, and this one is the Fair Play, Fair Pay Act.
Yes.
So that's what's been put forward to Congress, which is basically saying that FM, AM radio stations, and indeed anyone who plays a recorded music in public, needs a license from the record industry and they should be paying royalties. And so they want law change. So these are all under debate in the political community in the US. And this Mike Coalition was formed by all the people who license music. So this was radio stations. It was some digital services that license. It was people representing restaurants and bars who play music in a public space. And so they all formed a united front, the idea being that if they all went to Washington together, rather than radio people saying this and digital people saying this and bars and restaurant people saying this, if they all went to Washington as one and said, the music industry are just being money-grabbing bastards here, then they'd have more chance of fighting off both the collective licensing reform for the publishers and the addition of the general performance right for sound recordings in the US. So that is what the Mike Coalition is, although not quite as united a front as was originally intended.
Who were the big names involved at the start? Google's in there.
Google's in there. Pandora, which when it comes to collective licensing is one of the big enemies of the American record and music publishing industries. Pandora was in there. iHeart Radio, iHeart Media, who obviously own a lot of the AM, FM radio stations.
Clear Channel.
Used to be called Clear Channel, one of the big radio broadcasters in the US, who also have a Pandora-type streaming service called iHeart Radio. They were in there. And Amazon were in there, and NPR, or National Public Radio, which is sort of the less commercial side of radio in America, were also part of the coalition.
Yes,
but
although
no more.
So, well, first of all, Amazon pulled out. Why did Amazon pull out?
Amazon said when the Mike Coalition launched, they had a big long list of things that they were supposedly lobbying on.
Yeah.
So mainly the things I've just mentioned, but some other stuff too. Amazon pulled out. They were the first to withdraw. And what they said was, well, actually, there's only one issue that we care about. Amazon said, we don't care about the collective licensing thing. We don't care about the FM radio thing because we don't own any FM radio stations. The only thing we care about is the fact that it's really hard to find out who owns copyright, and particularly music copyright. And so we want to force the music industry to have a database that tells us these record companies own these records, these music publishers and collecting societies control these songs, so that it would be easier to pay everybody.
Well, the music industry obviously tried to do that, and it fell apart. The global repertoire database didn't get anywhere, did it?
Yeah, that was the music publishers trying to do a central database. It didn't work. And in some ways, you know, I mean, this is sort of Amazon asking for the thing that everyone in the music industry knows they should be able to do but can't.
Yeah.
So, I mean, actually, I think Amazon scored quite a few brownie points because this Mike Coalition was controversial in the music industry. The record companies and music publishers and songwriters and artists were saying this is just big tech and the big radio companies ganging up to pay artists and songwriters less money. That's what this is about. And Amazon were able to say, actually, that's not what we're interested in. We want to pay you more money. We want to know who to pay. And so Amazon said, we thought that data was a big part of this. It's become very apparent that for everyone else in the coalition, they don't really care about that. They just want to stop the publishers and the labels getting more money. And so we don't really want a part of that. So we're withdrawing. So Amazon left a few weeks ago.
Yes. And now NPR has followed. Now, NPR is kind of the fluffy face of American radio and sort of, I mean, seen as being a kind of a friend of the music industry. I mean, a lot of the big sort of pre-release streams of albums in the US come through NPR, which has always seemed a bit odd.
Yeah, why aren't they giving those exclusives to Spotify? Yeah, like, but NPR gets them all, doesn't they?
Yeah. And now they followed, seemingly not so much by just realising that, you know, the issues they're interested in are not the same as everyone else, but actually just from pressure from various sides.
Yes.
To get them to pull out.
When Amazon pulled, there's an organisation called Music First, which is sort of lobbying on a lot of these issues, and it sort of is the foe of Mike Coalition, if you like. And they specifically mentioned NPR in their statement. They were sort of saying, yes, well done, Amazon, for standing up for artists and songwriters. And it's really weird that NPR was still
they
in
this... They were kind of going like, yeah, we know Google are bastards, and we know Pandora, well, you know, we hate them. But NPR, come on!
And so NPR have withdrawn from the coalition. They didn't really explain why. They didn't put out any official statement other than to confirm that they were no longer part of this alliance. But as you say, I mean, they generally have a really good relationship. I mean, they need to, you know, manage the royalty payments that they make, but they enjoy a good relationship with labels and with Artists Direct. And as you say, they get all of those exclusives on their website. So they are out of the Mike coalition. So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see if any others... I mean... Of all the people involved, most of the rest, I suspect, are there to get royalty payments down.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's not like Pandora have been quiet about that.
So I don't know whether we're going to see any more exits, but it was interesting, obviously widely welcomed by the music community, both the labels and the artists. That said, even without Amazon and NPR on board, I mean, that is a mighty coalition. And also just the broadcast lobby. I mean, the mainstream radio stations in the US are so powerful in Washington, because talk radio in the US has a big influence politically. So it's still, I think, a tall order for what the music industry is trying to achieve over there. I think they will get the collective licensing reforms. I think they'll get that. And Pandora won't like that, but I think they will. Getting that AM, FM money, I mean... Really, it's mad that we've got to 2015 and the radio stations are still not paying. We talked about the whole pre-1972 thing last week.
Well, yeah, and the ruling that sort of suggested that the music industry had just should be getting that money, and just, you know, it's their fault for not claiming
exactly
it.
Exactly, for sort of 50s and 60s repertoire. So, I mean, there's lots of arguments why this is the time to introduce that general performing right for sound recordings, but that's the one where I'm not 100% convinced, even though some of the opponents are falling down. That Mike coalition is still very strong, and I think if they could stop the general performing right for recordings, they would sort of reluctantly accept the publishers doing direct dealing on the digital over here. So this story definitely not over, but an interesting development nonetheless.
Just quickly, time to run through some of the stories we didn't have time to properly look through this week on the podcast. 50 Cent declared himself bankrupt.
Big front page news, this.
Whose worth is valued at over $100 million.
This is all linked into another court case, though. So he was found liable for invading the privacy of a woman who he leaked a sex tape. As part of a beef with Rick Ross. Rick Ross wasn't in the sex tape.
No.
It was that the woman who was had the child of Rick Ross. And so he was ordered to pay this woman $5 million. Also, they were going to see if any punitive damages were also due. So you sort of sense that this is all linked into that.
Yeah, he was... Well, I mean, it is speculative that there's a link, but it's
Allegedly.
It's coincidental, let's say, that the day he was supposed to be submitting his account so that it could be looked through by the court to work out what other damages he should pay on top of this $5 million... He went, actually, no, I haven't got any money.
Yeah.
Completely bankrupt.
Applied for bankruptcy protection, which in theory should just...
It's in fact the second time he's done that.
So it puts the case on hold, although the legal reps of the woman who should be getting the $5 million have put in their own application to the court saying, OK, put everything else he's doing on hold, but don't put this case on hold. So it'll be interesting to see whether or not that works out for 50 Cent.
There was a report published by the Berklee College of Music.
There was. It's an interesting report looking at digital rights and digital royalties and basically confirming what we already knew, which is it's incredibly complicated and nobody knows what's going on. It's worth checking that report out. It's free to download. I think you have to give them your email address. I think the most interesting thing in there was the suggestion that you could use the blockchain technology. Do you like blockchain technology?
I love it. Love it.
Which is what powers the Bitcoin currency, that technology could be used to have a much more efficient way of reporting and paying royalties, which is something quite a few people have been talking to me about recently.
Yeah, although I did see a conversation on Twitter yesterday where someone was talking about our report on that, and someone else came in and went, yeah, I tried to do that with my label and it doesn't work.
And it also still has all the problems of it would only work if there was a central database of copyright ownership, which I refer you to the previous discussion. There isn't. But anyway, read that report.
Last week, we discussed that the enemy was going to go free in September. This week, we found out the enemy final paid edition will come out on the 1st of August.
Actually, it's coming out on the 30th of July. It'll be dated the 1st of August.
Oh.
But the key thing there for maths fans is it means there'll be something like a six-week gap between the last paid-for edition and the first free edition.
So it's going to be a bumper edition that costs more than usual, £3.50, and I suppose it's supposed to last that 6 weeks.
But all those indie labels who shouted at me earlier for saying that nobody releases any music in August and early September are going to be really annoyed that there'll be no NME to try and get some coverage in. So, yeah.
Ah, well, wait till September. I'm sure it'll all be in the first issue of the free one. The FTC is looking into what is being termed the Apple tax.
That's what I call it.
Actually, I saw someone else call it that first. It's not yours.
It's not mine.
You can't claim that.
That's not my term. So this is if you subscribe to Spotify on the iPhone and you sign up through the app rather than signing up on Spotify's website and then entering your login on the iPhone, Apple take 30% of the money. Spotify can't afford to pay 30% of the money to Apple, so they just charge you another $3 a month.
Spotify's not the only app that does this.
And two things happened this week. First of all, in the wake of Apple Music, we heard that Spotify were emailing every customer affected by this and saying, you do realise you're paying $3 more a month than you need to, but in order to stop doing that, you have to cancel your subscription through the app and then have a new subscription through the web. But the news this week is that the FTC in the US is looking whether or not this is actually, especially now that Apple's in streaming music and therefore in competition with Spotify and Deezer, etc.,
yes,
is it actually a anti-competitive? Is it an antitrust issue?
Because Apple will be charging $9.99 for its streaming service and then force the others to charge an extra $3 because they can't afford to take that hit.
Yeah, unfair advantage.
And lastly on this list, the Troubadour is up for sale.
West London venue in Earl's Court.
Very famous West London
venue. It is indeed. And it's a cafe that has music rather than being a grotty pub somewhere in Camden. So a long history, particularly associated with sort of the folk scene of the late 50s and the 60s. But, you know, continues to play. These sort of singer-songwriters and acoustic people have often played there. And as with all little grassroots music venues, struggling at the moment because all their costs are going up, it's still really hard to persuade people to pay more money to come and see a sort of really intimate gig.
When people say that live music is booming, they really kind of mean
arenas and,
you know,
the O2.
Big budget live music.
So they're facing all these challenges. They also had one of those pesky noise abatement orders, which means that they can't let people sit in their garden area after a certain time, which is where people like to go and chill and smoke, I guess. So that sort of hindered their ability. So the guys who own it are selling it. And obviously, I mean, people who buy it might keep it going in its current way. 1954, I think, it was originally opened. So, I mean, it's a really old venue.
They have published a statement on their website saying, this doesn't mean that it's closing down. It just means that it needs a rethink.
Yes, but who knows? Yeah, it'll probably turn into another Starbucks or something. So the future of that nice little venue is looking a little bit insecure.
It's time to talk about one more thing before we go. Let's go back to a story that's featured on the podcast several times already. It's the Foo Fighters and their contract that they make live photographers sign.
So we've originally talked about this in the context of Taylor Swift, didn't we? So when Taylor Swift did her standing up to Apple over streaming royalties and the proposal that Apple not pay during the free trial, then woo for Taylor Swift, but then some photographers came out of the woodwork and said, well, it's great that you're sticking up for the little guy creator, but have you seen the contract you make us sign when we come and take photos of you at a gig that basically says we can only use the photos once, we can't re-license them, you can use our photos on your website and whatever you like. Actually, you're screwing over us as photographers. And Taylor Swift's people said, no, we're not. And then,
Well, then the Irish Times came out and said
it wasn't sending a photographer.
Well, it was after she played two shows in Dublin, and it was after the first one. They said, we're not publishing any pictures from this show because the contract she makes us sign is ridiculous, and it's just not viable to send out a photographer to go and take photographs of Taylor Swift when you can't really make any money out of the photographs.
Or use them beyond the first time. But it's not just Taylor Swift.
So I think it was the Washington City paper came out after and said, well, actually the Foo Fighters have a pretty draconian contract too, and they published an article saying, yeah, we're not sending, we're not publishing any photos of this Foo Fighters show because the contract they're asking us to sign is absolutely ridiculous.
As far as I'm aware, Foo Fighters haven't actually responded to this.
No.
Even though we reported on it, and then in the week that followed, it got reported quite widely around the world.
But then Foo Fighters, I mean, Dave Grohl specifically, like Taylor Swift, is sort of, seen as
the friendly face.
Nice guys of the music industry. And then there's people going, but look at these contracts they're making people sign. But this week there was a new development in this. I mean, actually, when the Irish Times published their article, I said on the podcast, it would be nice to see other newspapers follow suit. And I thought it would be nice, but I didn't actually think it would happen. But it is starting to happen. And this week's development in this was quite funny.
It was. So it wasn't just a newspaper following the Irish Times lead and the Washington City Papers lead by saying, we're not going to have any pictures to go over our article. They found a loophole.
Yes.
We love a loophole. What was the loophole?
The loophole was, it was Canadian newspaper Le Soleil. French language newspaper, because some people speak French in Canada.
Especially in Quebec City.
In Quebec City, where the Foo Fighters were briefly played before they were rained off at the weekend. Rather than signing a contract that they felt was unfair to photographers, they found a loophole where they just sent a cartoonist.
So they sent the guy who does the cartoons for the paper, who presumably doesn't need access. Obviously, it's hard for them to stop a photographer being at the back and taking photos, given these days everyone holds up their bloody phones and takes photos. But the point is, the control they have over photographers is that press photographers want to get into the front. And so they have an area, the big venues, an area at the front where the press photographers can get to. So that's what they are not allowing you to do without signing these contracts. But presumably the cartoonist just sort of stood at the back, watched the gig, and then went home and drew what was in his head. Or, yeah, I don't know, he was drawing it there and then on a pad. But there was a nice little cartoon of,
yes,
Dave Grohl with his broken leg.
In the rain.
In the rain. It was a lot of sort of scrawl, or wasn't there? Presumably that was showing the rain. I thought it was quite a good cartoon. I'd rather, yeah, look at that than some, generic gig photo.
And it was a funny way of dealing with this story. And, and it's a thing people talk about, raise awareness of this. And then maybe more newspapers will come forward and say, we're not doing this. This is ridiculous.
They'll all start sending cartoonists. So
and then there'll be contracts with cartoonists.
There will be. And, very soon when you get to a gig venue, security will be like, any pencils, any pencils, no pencils allowed in the venue. We're not having any cartoonists breaking the rules. So, yes, that's something to look forward to.
Well, we can look forward to that. I'm going to spend the next week looking forward to it while I wait for the next CMU podcast, because this one has come to an end, unfortunately. But while I've got you all here listening, why don't you subscribe if you haven't already, so you just get this automatically every Friday. It will be great. You can subscribe in all sorts of places, wherever you get your podcasts. And then you can also, I should point out, it's available on shareable media like SoundCloud, Mixcloud, that sort of thing. Why don't you put a link on your Twitter or something? And follow us on Twitter, at CMU, and follow us on Facebook, it's a Complete Music Update. There's so much you can do. Give us a review, rate us, all those things.
You'll be pleased to hear that he's now gone through all of his bullet
points. I've gone through all the stuff. Just help us get this podcast out there, because obviously everyone should be listening to this. It's important.
Yes.
We're talking about here.
Tell your friends, tell your neighbours, tell your cab drivers.
Grab the nearest person to you and just say, this is important. And then wave your phone at them or something.
But mainly people who either work in music or are very interested in music.
No, everyone.
All right then, everyone.
I won't be happy until everyone is listening.
Okay. It's a good ambition to aim for.
Yeah.
Hey, why don't you do the very, very final bit of the podcast and then I can go home.
This was the CMU podcast. It was presented by me. I am Andy Malt. And that guy, he was Chris Cook and probably still is. It's produced by Matt Peaty. And for more information on CMU and to read the show notes for this episode, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at Unique Facilities, the CMU podcast is an unlimited production in association with 7 Digital.